This is Anna Ninkai K, and you are listening to Voice of the Water Lily. Where do I even start this week? Every week, this slaughter gets worse. On February 29th, 2024, very early in the morning, 100 people, more than 100 people in the north of Gaza, in Gaza City, were savagely massacred as they tried to get aid from the very limited number of trucks that go up north. And 1,000 were injured in a matter of less than 10 minutes. What a disgraceful, vile, heinous war crime. This is while mainly children are starving to death. Starving to death. I've seen images that look like they come from some Nazi concentration camp in the 1940s. But they are not. They're coming from the Israeli concentration camp called Gaza. I won't forget what I've seen. There's been at least 20 people starved to death this week, mainly children. Just today, just right before I recorded this, I saw in the news that the latest victim of this starvation is a one-day-old baby. A baby that was starved to death before ever having a chance to live. Think about it. In what world is this acceptable? In what world? Because it'll never make sense to me. The famine that was feared for months is happening in Gaza. And remember, Gaza is not starving. Gaza is being starved. Gaza is being starved to death. Now I have to talk about Aaron Bushnell. I want to recommend to you all the great article that Chris Hedges wrote on his Substack about Aaron. I'll link it above because I think he really puts it best. But I also want to share a few of my own words about him. Aaron Bushnell, the young man, 25 years old, that self-immolated in front of the U.S., the Israeli embassy in Washington, D.C. First of all, Aaron was not mentally ill. He was human. He felt that the only thing left to stop this barbaric slaughterhouse was to sacrifice his life in one of the most painful and horrific ways possible. I cried so hard seeing the video to hear him screaming his last words as he set himself on fire, screaming "Free Palestine" until he physically could not anymore. Because those screams were the ones that had been trapped in my chest for months, ever since this genocide began. I just wish I could tell him there was another way, that the world was better with him in it. I just pray and affirm that his ultimate sacrifice will not be in vain, because Palestine will be free. So we take a deep breath and we read some poetry from one of the greatest to ever give us a look inside of the soul and mind of a poet, Pablo Neruda. There are so many lessons to be taken from his poems, so many feelings to be shared, and an immense amount of insight. So here we go. Before we start, of course, we have to start with a song. Nothing is more applicable these days than Sobreviviendo from Iyapu. They changed the line, Y no puedo olvidarme de Hiroshima, to say, Y no puedo olvidarme de Palestina, several years ago. And I just can't stop listening to this song ever since I first heard it. So you're going to hear it again today, and you're going to continue hearing it for a while, because I just love it so much. So here is Sobreviviendo from Iyapu.
Preguntaron, sobreviviendo, dije, sobreviviendo. Tengo un poema escrito más de mil veces. En él repito siempre que mientras salgue, no panda muerte. Sobreviviendo, todos frente al peligro, sobreviviendo, que se arranque hombres, sobreviviendo. Sobreviviendo,
eso fuerte,
sobreviviendo. eso que yo reía como un jilguero. Tengo cierta memoria que me lastima, no puedo olvidarme de Palestina.
Poetry is good for the soul, so we're going to start. It is medicine. It is so powerful. So we're going to start with one, with Pablo Neruda, The Day Will Come, from his Canto General. Liberators, in this twilight of America, in the morning's forsaken darkness, I give you my people's infinite leaf, the exaltation of every hour of struggle. Blue hussars fallen in the depths of time, soldiers in whose newly embroidered flags awaken. Today's soldiers, communists, combatant heirs of the metallurgic torrents, heed my voice born of the glaciers raised aloft in the daily bonfire through sheer love of duty. We're from the same land, the same persecuted people, the same struggle encircles the waste of our America. Have you seen in the night your brother's somber cave? Have you fathomed his sinister life? The scattered heart of the people, abandoned and submerged. Someone who received the hero's peace stored it away in his wine cellar. Someone stole the fruits of the bloody harvest and divided the geography, establishing hostile shores, zones of desolate blind shadow. Glean from the lands the shrouded throb of sorrow, the solitude, the wheat of the threshed fields. Something germinates beneath the flags. The ancient voice calls us again, descend to the mineral roots, and in the desolate metal's veins reach mankind's struggle on earth. Beyond the martyrdom that mauls the hands destined for the light, don't renounce the day bestowed upon you by those who died struggling. Every spike is born of a grain seeded in the earth, and like the wheat, the innumerable people join roots, accumulate spikes, and in the tempest unleashed, they rise up to the light of the universe. And I find that to be so powerful because it really is a trust that the day will come, as the title says, that our liberation will come, and that we will, and I love that last line so much, rise up to the light of the universe. There are two poems that I'm going to read next that I always associate with each other, maybe because they're right next to each other in the book, but they were about two very large and incredibly important American companies that were operating around the world. But Neruda, of course, talks about Latin America because he was from Chile. And he talks about Standard Oil Company, and then he talks about the United Fruit Company. Both of these corporations really operated as criminal enterprises around the world. Standard Oil Company, it wasn't known at the time that Neruda wrote this poem, but it was actually during World War II supplying the Nazis with oil. So they were a criminal enterprise, and they had a very large effect in South America and Latin America. So he writes this poem, Standard Oil Company, and I find it to be so, he brings together so many different things, not just the mindset of these monopolies, of these corporations and their owners who live far removed from the realities that they actually cause in the places where, say, they drill for oil. But also he personifies and talks about the oil itself as an entity, and talks about how it kind of finds that it is now under the ownership of a company. And it really kind of provoked my thought. I know that's not what he was writing at the time, because this is long before we knew about climate change. But it kind of provokes kind of some thoughts about that as well, about, you know, that when these companies came to drill oil, and they kind of took something that is an entity that comes from, you know, the past eras of the earth, where all the, you know, the plant matter, you know, under pressure became oil. That is like causing this whole civilization that we live in today to exist. And I guess a lot of people don't come from a more spiritual, supernatural kind of perspective with this. But I think about it, and I'm like, it is an entity, and it's like founded on the, you know, ancient forests. And that's all very spiritual to me. So I know he wasn't thinking that when he wrote this, but still it kind of provokes those thoughts for me. So I'm actually going to get to it and stop talking and start reading. Standard Oil Company. When the drill bored down towards the stony fissures and plunged its implacable intestine into the subterranean estates and dead years, eyes of the ages imprisoned plants, roots, and scaly systems became strata of water, fire shut up through the tubes, transformed into cold liquid in the customs house of the heights, issuing from its world of sinister depth, it encountered a pale engineer and a title deed. However entangled the petroleum's arteries may be, however the layers may change their silent sight and move their sovereignty amid the earth's bowels, when the fountain gushes its paraffin foliage, Standard Oil arrived beforehand with its checks and its guns, with its governments and its prisoners. Their obese emperors from New York are suave, smiling assassins who buy silk, nylon, cigars, petty tyrants, and dictators. They buy countries, people, seas, police, county councils, distant regions where the poor hoard their corn like misers their gold. Standard Oil awakens them, clothes them in uniforms, designates which brother is the enemy. The Paraguayan fights its war, and the Bolivian wastes away in the jungle with its machine gun. A president assassinated for a drop of petroleum, a million-acre mortgage, a swift execution on a mourning mortal with light petrified in a new prison camp for subversives in Patagonia, a betrayal, scattered shots beneath a petroliferous moon, a subtle change of ministers in the capital, a whisper like an oil tide, and zap, you'll see how Standard Oil's letters shine above the clouds, above the seas, in your home, illuminating their dominions. Next, I will read the United Fruit Company. I find it important to note. So the United Fruit Company was immensely powerful in Latin America. At one point, they actually owned 75% of Guatemala's land. And they were the reason why the CIA, they're one of the reasons why the CIA invaded the country and overthrew Arbenz, because Arbenz was going to, he was the president at the time, and he was going to do agrarian reform. And the United Fruit Company disliked that so much that they basically had the U.S. government overthrow him. And then that led to decades of horror in Guatemala that's not over. I mean, even what's happening in Guatemala today, you have 50% of children under the age of 5 are malnourished in rural Guatemala. It's actually quite horrifying. That all goes back to the United Fruit Company is really an important place to go back to and look at what they did and their role inside of the decades of horror that Guatemala has gone through. Of course, they operated all over, especially Central America and in the Caribbean, and they were one of the main forces behind the Banana Wars. And I am going to get to and do a show about the Banana Wars, because it was literally just the United States invading a bunch of countries in Central America and the Caribbean over and over and over for a period of more than 30 years to protect the interests of companies like the United Fruit Company. So we're going to hear Neruda's analysis, his perfect analysis of the United Fruit Company. When the trumpet blared, everything on earth was prepared, and Jehovah distributed the world to Coca-Cola, Inc., Anaconda, Ford Motors, and other entities. United Fruit, Inc. reserved for itself the juiciest, the central seaboard of my land, America's sweet waste. It rebaptized its lands, the Banana Republics, and upon the slumbering corpses, upon the restless heroes who conquered renown, freedom, and flags, it established the comic opera. It alienated self-destiny, regaled Caesar's crowns, unsheathed envy, drew the dictatorship of flies, Trujillo flies, Tacho flies, Scarias flies, Martinez flies, Ubico flies, flies soaked in humble blood and jam, drunk flies that drone over the common grave, circus flies, clever flies, versed in tyranny. Among the bloodthirsty flies, the United Fruit Co. disembarks ravaging coffee and fruits for its ships that spirit away our submerged land's treasures like serving trays. Meanwhile, in the seaport's sugary abysses, Indians collapse, buried in the morning mist. A body rolls down, a nameless thing, a fallen number, a bunch of lifeless fruit dumped in the rubbish heap. That was United Fruit Company. And I also find it important to mention that Che Guevara was deeply, deeply impacted by that poem, so much so when he was on his journey and he was going through his whole motorcycle journey through South America. He, you know, in his diary that he kept during that time, he actually wrote out this poem, and it just had such a profound effect on him, because we're seeing this company, this U.S. company, not only exploiting the people, exploiting the land, but also controlling the politics of entire countries. So yes, these companies like the United Fruit Company operated as criminal enterprises. We're going to read one more poem before we get to some music. Here is, "So is my life. My duty moves along with my song. I am not. That is my destiny. I exist not if I do not attend to the pain of those who suffer. They are my pains, for I cannot be without existing for all who are silent and oppressed. I come from the people and I sing for them. My poetry is song and punishment. I am told you belong to darkness, perhaps, perhaps, but I walk toward the light. I am the man of bread and fish, and you will not find me among books, but with women and men. They have taught me the infinite." I think that's such a powerful message about principles. And there were always people, yeah, I've kind of experienced some of that in my own life, people that want you to stay silent in the face of oppression, that asks you to renounce your principles, and in that meaning, renounce yourself, renounce who you are, and kind of remove yourself from these inextricable principles that you have. And I just love the way Neruda addresses that in "So Is My Life." We're going to get to another song. The only reason I chose this song is because I like it. That's literally the only reason. It's from Manuel Garcia and Guilamino, and it's called "Alzaré el Crit." And it is mostly in Catalan. This is sung, and I absolutely love it. Enjoy.
Passat altres mans, el desig i la sang s'afanyaven per mi. entorn meu, bullen remotament les ciutats sense mi. No em preguntis on vaig, que no m'alço ni em moc, tanco els ulls i la llum no s'adona de mi. Els records són feixucs o lleugers, tant se val, hi ha una veu pels camins que s'aparta de mi. No he dit mai a ningú el meu nom i el meu mal, els diré quan la mort s'enamori de mi. Si em retrob o em conec a la nova claror, provarà del sal crit so que resti de mi.
Next poem kind of follows the same thing as the last one, where he talks about people asking him not to portray the reality, not to portray the struggles and the oppression of his people. This one's called Do Not Ask Me. Some people ask me that human affairs with names, surnames, and laments not be dealt with in the pages of my books, not to give them space in my verses. They say poetry died here. Some say I should not do it. The truth is I do not want to please them. I greet them, I tip my hat to them, and I leave them voyaging the Parnassus like happy rats in cheese. I belong to another category. I am only a man of flesh and bones. Therefore, if they beat my brother, I defend him with what I have in hand. And each one of my lines carries the threat of gunpowder or steel that will fall over the inhuman, over the cruel, and over the arrogant. But the punishment of my furious peace menaces neither the poor nor the good. With my lamp I search for those who fall. I soothe and close their wounds. These are the chores of a poet, of the aviator, and of the stonecutter, and should do something on this earth, because we were born on this planet and we must arrange man's society, because we are neither birds nor dogs. And so if when I attack what I hate, or when I sing to those I love, poetry wants to abandon the hopes of my manifesto. I follow the letter of my law, accumulating stars and armaments in my steadfast duty to America. One more rose does not matter. I have a pact of love with beauty. I have a pact of blood with my people. And that really is, again, following that same thing of our, you know, where is your allegiance? And Neruda made it very clear that his allegiance was with his people to the very end. No one was going to take that from him. No one was going to dictate how he, what his art, what he portrayed in his art. And it is so true that the hands of the people really did appear in Neruda's poems. They really did. He always stood really so true to that. Next we go to Ode to the Atom. Infinitesimal star, you seemed forever buried in metal, hidden your diabolic fire. One day someone knocked at your tiny door. It was man. With one explosion he unchained you. You saw the world. You came out into the daylight. You traveled through cities. Your great brilliance illuminated lives. You were a terrible fruit of electric beauty. You came to hasten the flames of summer, and then wearing a predator's eyeglasses, armor, and a checked shirt, sporting sulfuric mustaches and a prehensile tail, came the warrior and seduced you. Sleep, he told you. Curl up, Adam. You resemble a Greek god, a Parisian modestite. In springtime, lie down here on my fingernail. Climb into this little box, and then the warrior put you in his jacket as if you were nothing but a North American pill, and he traveled through the world and dropped you on Hiroshima. We awakened. The dawn had been consumed, all the birds burned to ashes, an odor of coffins, gas from tombs thundered through space, the shape of punishment arose, hideous, superhuman, bloody mushroom dome, cloud of smoke, sword of hell. Burning air arose, spreading death on parallel waves, reaching the mother sleeping with her child, the river fishermen and the fish, the bakery and the bread, the engineer and his buildings. Everything was acid, dust, assassin, air. The city crumbled its last honeycombs and fell suddenly, demolished. Rotten men were instant lepers. They took their children's hand, and the little hand fell off in theirs. So from your refuge in the secret mantle of stone in which fire slept, they took you, blinding spark, raging light, to destroy lives, to threaten distant existences, beneath the sea, in the air, and on the sands, in every twist and turn of the ports, to destroy seeds, to kill cells, to stunt the corolla. They destined you, Adam, to level nations, to turn love into a black pustule, to burn heaped up hearts and annihilate blood. Mad spark, go back to your shroud, bury yourself in your mineral mantle, be blind stone once again, ignore the outlaws and collaborate with life, with growing things, replace motors, elevate energy, fertilize planets. You have no secret now, walk among men without your terrible mask, pick up your pace and pace the picking of the fruit, parting mountains, straightening rivers, and making fertile. Adam, overflowing cosmic cup, return to the peace of the vine, to the velocity of joy. Return to the province of nature. Place yourself at our service instead of the fatal ashes of your mask, instead of the unleashed infernos of your wrath, instead of the menace of your terrible light. Deliver to us your amazing rebelliousness for our grain, your unchained magnetism, to found peace among men, and then your dazzling light will be happiness, not hell. Hope of morning, gift to earth. I find that one so interesting and so powerful, because he's describing again what human beings have done with something that, in fact, this kind of reminds me of things that my father used to talk about. He would speak about nuclear power, nuclear energy, atomic bombs, things like that quite often, and he would talk about how these things, the things that used to make, you know, nuclear power, atomic bombs, all these things, are very deep in the earth. They're not meant to be, they're covered by the earth, right? It's very hard to get to these things. And he said, he would say that it was, that there was like that for a reason, right? The earth had covered these things because people weren't supposed to interact with them. But then what do people do? You know, people, they go and they want to do what they want to do. And they go and then they use this for, not for anything good, which is possible to use this power for something good, but they use it then to drop a bomb, to drop a nuclear bomb on Hiroshima. I just find it really interesting because I know my father, he never read that poem. He didn't read Pablo Neruda, but still it was like they came to the same conclusion, very different times, different spaces. And without, you know, my father didn't get that from Neruda's poem because I know he didn't read that poem, but still it's just so powerful, the connections, the spiritual connections that are there. We're going to go to another poem. I will return. Some other time, man or woman, traveler, later when I am not alive, look here, look for me, between stone and ocean, in the light storming through the foam, look here, look for me, for here I will return without saying a thing, without voice, without mouth, pure, here I will return to be the churning of the water, of its unbroken heart, here I will be discovered and lost, here I will perhaps be stone and silence. There's something I love so much about that last poem. Because it talks about how immortal the spirit and the soul is and how it just kind of goes through time. But it also has this beautiful feeling of oneness, of being such a, you know, a part of the earth, because he talks about being a stone and things like that. I think it's just so beautiful and something soothing about that beautiful poem and kind of this assurance that he will, and that the spirit, not just him, but the spirit, anyone's, you know, spirit is there. It's also kind of an assurance to me of how everlasting our ancestors are. I just love it so much. It's just it's a very soothing poem to me. But we're going to go to I Call Upon You. We inherit this from the past, and today the face of Chile is magnified. After leaving behind so many sorrows, I need you, young brother, young sister, to listen to what I am saying. I do not believe in inhuman hatred. I do not believe man is the enemy. I believe that with your hand in mine, facing the enemy and opposing his punishment, we will fill this country with joy, delicious and golden as wheat. And I love that one because it just talks about this feeling of unity. And it is really the most necessary thing right now. It is what we all need to be. We all need to be united. It is essential. It is absolutely essential. We need to be united for all that is good, for justice, for peace, and for freedom, for the freedom freedom and justice for all people. But this next poem is only two lines long, but it, for some reason, it just hit me so, it was so powerful that I just had to include it. So I want you to listen closely and just maybe think about, this is a poem that I definitely reflect on, right? Because it just communicates something that the soul understands. So here it is. It's called Point. There is no space wider than that of grief. There is no universe like that which bleeds. I'm not going to try to say what I think that's about or my thoughts about it or try to intellectually understand it. But I would like to just leave that one for the soul to understand and take what it will. To feel the deeper meaning and be okay with not even, what I find important about poetry is to feel the deeper meaning, know what it means in your heart, but not be able to put it into words, but not have to intellectualize it. And I think that is the most beautiful thing about poetry. We can know what it means without understanding it, or we can sometimes not understand it and say, well, I know that the poet knew what he meant or she meant. And that's enough. And that it makes sense on the level that the soul understands. The soul understands poetry. But that last one, I'm going to be thinking about it a lot because I feel it on a very deep level. We're going to go to one last poem, but I feel it is the perfect one to end off today's show with because it is another one of those poems that gives you the sense of unity. It gives you a sense that you are joined in arm with comrades and you are marching towards a better future that you will together construct, that we together will construct. So here it is. The victorious people. My heart's in this struggle. My people will overcome. All the peoples will overcome one by one. These sorrows will be wrung like handkerchiefs until all the tears shed on the desert's galleries, on graves, on the steps of human martyrdom are squeezed dry. But the victorious times nearby, let hatred reign so that punishment's hands won't tremble. Let the hour hand reach its timetable in the pure instant, and let the people fill the empty streets with fresh and firm dimensions. Here's my tenderness for that time. You'll know it. I have no other flag. And let us end off here with a song with arguably one of my favorite covers, of the covers of many covers of Manifiesto, arguably one of the most beautiful, was Pedro Aznar, when he sang, the Argentine singer-songwriter, Pedro Aznar, when he sang Manifiesto live. I love this. I love the instrumentals on it. And Manifiesto is another song that is just so powerfully understood by the soul. No matter the language, no matter if you understand the words or not, I feel that it is one of those songs that just speaks to something deeper. But mi gente, we are at the end of today's show. I hope you enjoyed it. I hope you enjoyed taking this time to listen to the lessons listen to what Neruda has to say, listen to those lessons, share in those feelings, and enjoy really a look inside the soul and the mind of a poet. Until next time, mi gente, keep dancing, keep honoring your ancestors, never stop affirming for the right to live in peace, never stop affirming for justice and freedom for all oppressed people, but especially for the Palestinian people. Free Palestine, ceasefire now, con mucho, mucho cariño. Ciao, mi gente. Las estrellas.
canto tiene sentido cuando palpitan las venas del que morirá cantando las verdades verdaderas, no las lisonjas fugaces ni las famas extranjeras, sino el canto de una lonja hasta el fondo de la tierra.
Siempre será canción nueva.